It's wonderful to be with you again. Inspirational, really, to be with a gathering of friends who are very interested in something beyond the ordinary, interested in really something extraordinary. It's good when we gather in such a setting, with such goals as to move beyond our ordinary conditioned patterns. It's helpful to consecrate the setting. Now, consecrate means make sacred, but sacred means basically, at least in a more secular way, making something worthy of respect. And so there's a value as sanghas meet to have some pattern or some ritual that creates this space or this container that is worthy of respect. And what are we respecting but the aspiration to be different. So we generally start by an aspiration, and it's often very helpful to start that with a recognition of our extreme good fortune, the rare extreme good fortune that allows us to gather in a sangha dedicated to something which is totally extraordinary. And all of the causes and conditions and excellent circumstances that allow us to do this, we generate a consciousness of this and express gratitude. So in daily practice, it can be as simple as, I'm grateful for this opportunity to practice. Grateful for this opportunity to be in this setting with my sangha. And that is followed by the aspiration at the beginning of any activity that the background for the aspiration is we're doing something special. We're doing something out of the ordinary. And one way to recognize that is to make the aspiration of bodhicitta, the aspiration of awakened mind, which is the aspiration that this activity is not for ourselves alone, but our hope, our aspiration is that any transformation, any growth, any insights, any change in behavior benefits not us alone, but everyone we come in contact with and radiates out from there. And if we start with this recognition of creating a sacred space dedicated to not only recognizing our good fortune, but wanting to share it somehow through our study and practice, then in that simple ritual, we're making this gathering something worthy of respect. And it helps us to remember that in the gathering, we will try to behave differently than we do in our ordinary life. We, in this setting, are dedicated to supporting each other in the adventure of waking up. Waking up from the illusion of conditioned existence, which for many reasons we find unsatisfactory. That word unsatisfactory is often translated as suffering, but unsatisfactory is the actual literal definition of the word. And we're waking up to a much bigger view of ourselves in the entire universe. it's really an adventure. As we wake up, pain doesn't go away, but suffering fades because our relationship to everything is changing as we wake up. Our relationship to ourself, to others, to pain, to circumstances, to perceptions, that's changing. And as that changes, the unsatisfactory nature of existence fades. Pain is still there. Pain is part of having a body, but unsatisfactoriness or suffering does fade. So we're on this path to change our relationship with what we currently call self and other. Because in our conditioned existence, we're very aware of this division between self and other. And as we are changed by our practice, so is that relationship. Now, I've received wonderful questions from the Sangha over the last month, which are going to be the basis for tonight's discussion. I'm always really grateful for letters with questions or describing issues or problems. And the feedback I got have to deal with negative emotions. One or two of you in this room may have had negative emotions before. And negative emotions, in the descriptions that were coming to me from the Sangha, are often directed both inwardly and outwardly, are described as annoyance or judgments or impatience, disappointments, frustrations. Sometimes a feeling that we almost want to be ornery in the circumstances, or we feel justified in it. Sometimes feeling unkind towards ourselves or others. And so tonight, let's look at this general theme of negative emotions arising within ourselves and approach it several ways. Let's look at it through the lens of curiosity and compassion. And then look at a way of finding a way past our conditioned perceptions, seeing things differently. And we'll go on to something called revolutionary love. Love that term. So first, let's look at curiosity and compassion. We have negative emotions. We have deeply ingrained conditioned habits of reactivity, often negative. And then intense thoughts and emotions arise. And usually in there you can find grasping or pushing away. Then we tell ourselves stories about the situation as if it wasn't already bad. We make it worse by telling stories and then believing those stories about ourselves, about others. And these stories that we tell usually include judgments, hopes, and fears. It can be about ourselves or others. And we act as if these stories are real. And then we react based on the story we're telling ourselves and what we're believing in deeply conditioned patterns that we are really good at, very practiced at this. We suffer. the difficulty with addressing a theme like this is that it's tempting to get psychological, but the literature in Buddhism and elsewhere is full of psychological approaches. And it's important for us as Dharma practitioners to try to look more at Dharma approaches. And since the Dharma is the path of practice, the practices of waking up, then it's good to try to direct a talk towards things we can do, not just how things came to be, but things we can do about it. So thing one here is kindness starts at home. Kindness starts at home. And by home, let's talk about self. This I, me, mine that we're well acquainted with. Dharma practitioners in particular are at big risk of feeling so bad about having negative emotions that we actually turn them against ourselves. And this does not help us in training to be kind to all beings. So one of the important things we can do is, as we're dealing with negative emotions, and then as a Dharma practitioner, we think we shouldn't have negative emotions, and so then we start to get down on ourselves. We become unkind to ourselves, and we are practicing unkindness. That's 180 degrees off track. So when we notice negative thoughts or emotions or stories, when we notice them coming up, it's vital that we remind ourselves, first of all, that everything which can arise will arise in our mind. That's what the minds do, is they generate thoughts, and every kind of thought, every kind of emotion, every kind of story is being generated and will come up just triggered so quickly by circumstances. Even Dharma practitioners have everything arise in our field of consciousness. Good things, bad thoughts, bad thoughts. Thoughts we can be proud of, emotions we can be ashamed of, it's all coming up. So negativity, negative emotions, negative thoughts come up. They will. Our entire lives. We're not practicing the Dharma to make anything go away. In a way, it's like, this is an aside now, it's like learning English, learning a foreign language when you're already an English speaker. We are really good at being English speakers. In fact, in comparison with the rest of the world, we are the experts at speaking English. And many of you in this room have at one time or another, by choice or by having to comply with some school, have learned a foreign language or tried to. And as we're struggling to learn another language, English will keep popping up. We'll see something, the English word will pop up, and then we have to try to let go of our grasp on that and look at the other word and practice that transformation, letting go of the English word and grabbing on or orienting ourselves to the new word. And throughout that process, the English will keep popping up. And the same process in an analogous way is going on in the Dharma. We're trying to see the world and ourselves and have a new relationship in a different way, but the old things are going to keep popping up. And our job, just like in learning a foreign language, is to notice they've popped up, be forgiving about that. Of course, the English word pops up. And then letting go of our grasp on that, moving to the other. So back to everything arising. It's often hard for Dharma practitioners to accept that all of this negativity will arise all the time. And in times like this, when the suffering of the world seems very close at hand, our conditioning really easily turns us toward the negative. It's just how we're conditioned. One thing that can help in some situations if we're besieged by negative thoughts and feelings and things we shouldn't be is to ask, well, is this negativity I'm feeling unique, one of a kind? Are you the only Dharma practitioner in the world who's experiencing these feelings? That helps give us a little perspective on where we are. Are you the only angry person in the Dharma? No, clearly not. So then we remember the adage, welcome everything. So first of all, we're reminding ourselves that kindness starts at home. As these negative things come up, we need to be kind to ourselves and forgiving. And then as these things continue to come up, as they will, we need to welcome everything. Because otherwise we're pushing away, which is again 180 degrees off the training. So we welcome everything. And I recommend that you frequently reread Rumi's poem, The Guest House. It's a good reminder. Welcome your demons. Set a place for them at the table. Ask them what they want from you. So the demons include being overwhelmed by what's going on around you and overwhelmed by your own negative reactions and overwhelmed by your own negative thoughts and emotions and stories. And invite that overwhelm to the table. Rumi actually says in the poem to open the door with laughter and invite them in. I consider that advanced practice, to have the laughter. But we're heading that way. So in order to welcome everything, we have to be curious about what's happening. We have to be curious about what's going wrong. Curiosity helps us to recognize that something's wrong, that something's making us uncomfortable, that we're caught up in a familiar or maybe even an unfamiliar pattern. Sometimes it's first noticed in the body, other times it's mainly that we notice the emotions or we're freaked out about the thoughts we're having or the recurrent story. So we've looked at one practice opportunity of just starting the kindness practice at home and then welcoming everything and finding out what these demons are wanting. And then asking the question, what else is true? And this question, which arose from the trauma literature and is extremely helpful in helping trauma victims, is a powerful practice tool in the Dharma. So yes, we're having negative emotions, our demons are stirred up. What else is true? One way that you can practice this is to be curious about the other person or people who are involved in your negative thoughts. Our cycles of negative thinking often are triggered by our reactions to others. So I know that I'm upset. What else is true? Well, maybe they're upset too. What is their role? their story, their motivation. Here, there's a lot of value in putting ourselves in their shoes and wondering what it would have been like to be in their shoes during the encounter with you. How were they feeling? What were they reacting to? How did you look to them? That's pretty uncomfortable work, by the way. You must be willing to hear the answer. Without reverting to a habitual unkindness to yourself. That's where the curiosity comes in. I hear how I behaved, I immediately am ashamed, and I start to have negative cycles of thought about myself. That's being unkind. I need to be willing to hear it and then follow the practices, including curiosity. What can I learn from this? For me, one of the most valuable lessons in Buddhism is the fact that everything we encounter is the perfect teacher in that moment. And it's really important for us if we're going to be transforming ourselves and our perceptions and our relationships to the world, to remember that everything we encounter is potentially our best teacher in that moment. That's part of our changing relationship with the world. Learning to recognize everything is the teacher. So at this point, the practice of Tonglen has immense value. So as another practice, I know we spend a lot of time talking about Tonglen very, very recently. We had a handout last time or the time before, and if any of you didn't get the handout or have lost it, Gina has some other copies which she would be glad to share with you, but I'll read you tonight. The practice of Tonglen at this point can be really helpful. And at this point, as usual, until you're really good at Tonglen, begin with yourself. These are Pema's own words from that handout. She says, at this point, you can begin to do Tonglen for what you are feeling and for millions of others just like you who at that very moment of time are feeling exactly the same stuckness and misery. Maybe you are able to name your pain. You recognize it clearly. It's maybe revulsion or terror or anger or wanting to get revenge. So you breathe in for all the people who are caught with that same emotion. And you send out relief for whatever opens up the space for yourself and all those countless others. Maybe you can't name what you're feeling, but you can feel it. Tightness in the stomach, a heavy darkness, whatever. Just contact what you are feeling, breathe it in, take it in for all of us, and send out relief to all of us. Powerful practice, really powerful. Later, you can do Tonglen for the other people, the other person involved. And again, in Pema's words, we begin this by taking on the suffering of a person we know to be hurting and who we wish to help. For instance, you know of a child who's being hurt. You breathe in the wish to take away all the pain and fear of that child. Then if you breathe out, you send the child happiness, joy, or whatever would relieve their pain. This is the core of practice, breathing in another's pain so that they can be well and have more space to relax and open. And breathing out, sending them relaxation, or whatever you feel would bring them relief and happiness. Good timing. So these practices help us to loosen our attachment to our own thoughts and feelings, whether they're good thoughts and feelings or bad thoughts and feelings. As Frank has reminded us many times, pushing away is not what we're up to. Again, when you find yourself pushing away, that's your teacher in the moment. And as we loosen our attachments to our own negativity, our own self-grasping, then there's room for compassion to grow. Compassion for ourselves, compassion for others. And with the growth of compassion, there's more space in the situation, less sense of separation. It becomes less about us. Because when we're in a negative cycle of thinking, we almost feel like an island surrounded or isolated from others or from the world. Becomes less about us against the world and more about acceptance and even kindness towards self and other. Now, the risk of a Dharma talk is that it makes people think it should be easier than it actually is. Nothing easy about this. There's nothing easy about learning a new language, and there's definitely nothing easy about transforming our perceptions, inner and outer. But there's many similarities in learning a language or in practicing the Dharma. We fail at least as often as we succeed. We feel inept. Frequently, we can't tell if we're making any progress. But we keep going. The fourth of the paramitas, joyful diligence. There's a third thing, and that is a TED talk. Some of you may be acquainted with this already. One of my teachers sent it to Carol. It's called Three Lessons of Revolutionary Love. And it's by a young woman named Valerie Kaur, K-A-U-R. And I highly recommend this. She's not a Buddhist, she's a Sikh. A religion I've always respected. They have some wonderful teachings that are very much in line with what we're studying. And she's an American of Sikh descent. Anyway, revolutionary love, three lessons of revolutionary love in a time of rage. Three lessons of revolutionary love in a time of rage. And the way she presents it and the lessons she gives are wonderful. So highly recommended. Might even be something you someday want to watch as a group. Because I feel like it, in many ways, is the next practice step in this theme that we've been exploring tonight. And when we look at, if we look at practice in view, meditation, and action model, in the realm of action, classically, we're told to just be guided by the paramitas. Generosity, non-harming, patience, and joyful diligence are the first four of them. And I feel like in her talk, I don't even know if she knows what the paramitas are, but in her talk, she's giving beautiful demonstrations of this. I've watched it three times and I've never come away with dry eyes. So that's enough for tonight. It would be wonderful if there are any questions or requests for clarification or anything you all have as a response.
What is the name of the woman who gave the tantrum?
Her name, first name, Valerie, spelled V-A-L-A, V-A-L-A-R-I-E, Kaur, A-U-R. And she has two talks now. They're quite similar. The one that really has moved me is this one, The Three Lessons of Revolutionary Love in a Time of Rage. And one of the things that's so apt about it is that it doesn't really matter. She's a social activist. She's all about social justice. But it's equally apropos of our service on any level, whether it's a service of political nature or fighting racism or sexism or any injustice or working for protection of Mother Earth. The lessons she's teaching are appropriate in all of these settings as we try to be the change we want to see in the world. Her guidance is very appropriate for our times and very appropriate on the Buddhist path.
Hi, Terry.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Really good, thanks.
Good. Thank you for tonight's talk and this recommendation, the person and the revolutionary. I'm one of those people that listen to the impeachment talks, and by Friday night, I was vacillating between pretty extreme emotions.
Sure.
Rage and despair, and it stayed with me for a couple of days. We talked about it at dinner tonight. It just, for some of us, the depth of the emotions that have come up just are lingering for days. So I just wondered, in your listening to her, are there one or two things you would share with me about what you got from that woman and her speech? TED Talk?
You know, she influenced the talk quite a bit tonight. The very points I made are points that I, some of the points I got from her, like curiosity, which is an opening. You know, if we know we're closed, if we're curious, we're open. Important on the Buddhist path. And of course, love and compassion. And using her curiosity to open is similar to our own threefold path of view, meditation, and action. They're all feeding each other. And our view, meanwhile, is expanding, both when we directly practice it and as a result of our meditation and action. And you can see in her talk that her behavior is expanding her view. And as her view expands, her love and compassion and curiosity can expand too. And she's a young person, but she's talking about how some of these processes took her 15 years of cultivation before she could really put them in action. And Buddhist practitioners can understand time frames like that.
Yeah.
And I can't remember all of the things she's saying. I don't think she was talking that much about kindness to self, as I was stressing tonight. But in my experience, in the Dharma for a while now, I've noticed that there is this tremendous unkindness that arises in Buddhist practitioners regarding their own inner process. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's worthwhile looking at Rumi's poem regularly. Just as a reminder, to invite them all to the table, to all of these negative, disruptive, pain in the ass things that arise in our minds. Invite them all to the table, see what they have to say, see what they want from you. And there were mirrors of that in her talk, which I thought were quite inspiring. I can't overemphasize the self-kindness part of the Dharma path. We're so deeply conditioned to set a goal and feel bad about ourselves when we don't reach it. And there's no way to overemphasize the fact that the Dharma path is all about falling on your face a million times a day. And to somehow still maintain self-kindness. And I think that's underemphasized. But if we are negative towards ourselves and judgmental towards ourselves and our practice, and indulge these negative thoughts that will come up, then we're being unkind to ourselves and we're shooting ourselves in the foot in terms of our practice. They will come up. All of this stuff will come up. So what is incumbent upon a Dharma practitioner is to change our relationship to what comes up. And that's really where the view of emptiness comes in. And I was going to spend a lot of time on that tonight, but there isn't that kind of time. And it would have been boring as hell the way I was starting to formulate it. So we're saved from that. These things are hard to talk about, but just in the vernacular, as we change our view of the solidity of things, they're easier to let go of our grasping at. And the same is true with our negative thoughts. If we can look at our negative thoughts arise and practice the view on them, we can say, well, they're empty of inherent existence. Well, that doesn't help as much usually. But if we can understand that they're always going to come up and we have a choice at that moment between a conditioned response of saying, oh, I'm a failure, I'll never make it, I'm a bad person, I'm a bad Dharma practitioner, on and on and on. If we go that way, we haven't met the teacher. But if we remember to meet the teacher in that moment, as we're struggling with all these negative emotions, the teaching is that yes, they're going to come up, And yes, even a rudimentary view of their emptiness can help us see through them a little bit. So then when we finish watching the debates or the State of the Union, whatever horrible thing we subject ourselves to, which is a separate topic.
Sorry.
Yeah, all of this negative stuff comes up and we start to feel horrible, and then we start to feel horrible about ourselves for feeling horrible. We can remember that it's more transparent than that. Just in a pragmatic sense, we can say to ourselves, well, gosh, if I'm going to be dealing with this the rest of my life, all of this crap coming up all the time, I've got to change my relationship to it. Right? That's a huge dharma insight. So then it's more like it's popping up over here than in here. If that makes any sense, you know, just a little separation.
Yeah, yeah.
So instead of being in the movie, we gradually move ourselves out to sitting in the seats watching the movie. And as you all know, if you go into a movie as a Dharma practitioner and try to say, okay, I'm just going to watch it rather than be in it, you'll fail 100 times a minute, you know. Just, we get caught into the movie and we're in it and our emotions are stirred up, and then we can separate and move back and look at it the way a director would have been looking at it when he sees the movie for the 100th time. That's the kind of separation we want to practice as these emotions come up. Either we're drowning in them, or we're trying to push them away and feeling horrible that we can't, or we start to look at it as a movie and sit a little further back from the screen. I don't know whether that analogy makes much sense or not.
It does, and what tonight's helped me with is politically, I can sit in my judgment and point to the other side and wonder, why are they so angry?
Yeah.
And having my experience that I had over the last 4 or 5 days, I get it now. You know, it's like I've had the opportunity now to feel deep rage, deep despair, and if nothing else, I get why the other, I mean that facetiously, they're having those experiences as well. So I got that now. It's no longer us and them when it comes to rage and despair. I got it. And yeah. And there's a sweetness to that in a funny kind of odd way. I don't know if that makes sense. I get it.
You've invited your troublesome neighbor to the dinner table.
Yep, yep, yep. And it's because of this practice that, and where you've been going and where some of us have been going with Ajahn and other work, it's like the space is opened up for high volume of feelings that I would have heretofore judged, pushed away, been a bad Buddhist, whatever.
Right.
And now there's something like, oh, wow, that's intense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But from that wider space, it's just not quite so scary. Anyway.
And in the simplest way, every time you fall back into that and say, oh, I'm a bad Buddhist, you've met one of the valuable teachers. And so then you can change your relationship with that. That's your teacher then, that moment.
Yeah.
You know, another poem that really helps me, it's not quite as accessible as Rumi's, and it's more of a pain in the ass, is Call Me By My True Names.
Right. Cool.
That's really challenging.
Yeah, it is.
It's really worth reading every once in a while.
Yeah, it is. Now would be good. Now would be good. Thank you, Terry.
The lesson from that is something that has been demonstrated in non-Buddhist ways too. If you had the same conditioning, you would be behaving the same way.
Yeah.
There but for the grace of God, really.
Wow. Oof. Okay, that brings tears to my eyes.
This work does that.
Yeah. Thank you.
One of the phrases in Buddhism that I was taught was crack your heart open with compassion.
We sure need it right now. Thank you, dear.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Those were great questions. We have a few minutes if anybody else has anything they want to add. The dog has something to say. I wish I could understand. You know, this self-kindness thing is in each step, view, meditation, and action. As we're trying to understand the view and trying to see little things that can help us see the view, like trying to look in a mirror or differentiate the finger from pointing at the moon or whatever we're trying to do in finding the view, we feel like complete idiots. That's hard work. So self-kindness. Absolutely necessary, because otherwise it's impossible. You're going the opposite direction. And then in meditation, so easy to think you're not a good meditator, so easy to think that was a bad meditation session. You're getting tired of hearing me say this, but there is no bad meditation. We meditate in order to practice letting go. What are we letting go of? We're only letting go of our attachment to whatever it was that took us away. It has nothing to do with the thing that took us away. We're letting go of our attachment. We're practicing letting go. We're practicing this. And that's what meditation is. And that's like learning a foreign language. Choose Arabic. And meditation is about like that. I met a kid once who was at West Point, and he was studying Arabic, and his girlfriend was studying Mandarin, which is easier. And the Army really recognized this, and they set them on different courses. It took different amounts of time, and his was going to take, first takes about 5 years for fluency, and his was going to take at least 8. And the Dharma's harder. So no bad practice, no bad practitioner, no bad meditation. You're just practicing your Arabic, knowing it'll take you forever. And then activity, view, meditation, and action. We always will revert to our conditioned behaviors, always, you know, but less frequently over time, and catch ourselves more quickly over time. And we'll spend more time over the year talking about the Lojong, because besides the paramitas, the Lojong, especially the four thoughts and the Tonglen, are some of the most powerful ways of training the boat. And then whatever else you find in it. I mentioned last time that Carol and I find it really valuable to have cards, a card for each slogan. And you can either have the cards keyed to a book that you like, or you can actually write the slogan on one side and your interpretation from, or a quote from the book on the other side, and change the card once a day or once a week. I learn a lot from that. So day by day, as we can, we practice view, meditation, and action. We fall on our face. We think we're bad practitioners. We think our meditation is lousy, and we remember that's not being kind to ourselves, and there's a teaching in there somewhere, and we go through that little step, and then we keep going. And listen to Valerie. any of you who have any interest in applying yourself to the suffering of the world, this young woman offers a lot. Let's sit in silence for a minute to let all this settle in. Again, this period of silence is the bookend to the gratitude and aspiration, but it has nothing to do with thinking. We're not trying to review what we just learned or review our plan for our Dharma practice. We're just letting things settle. And then we finish with the dedication, which sounds a lot like the aspiration. We end with the dedication of anything positive that has come from this practice going to the benefit of all beings, to relieve their suffering and to help them on the path of awakening. Such a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Nice.
Right.
Send me letters. This whole talk was based on letters that came to me. So I'm deeply grateful when I know what's up in the Sangha, because then I know what to talk about. Otherwise, I'm working in the dark. Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Terry.
Is there any